Some voices in this podcast were generated by AI for additional diversity. Rest assured, everything has been translated, edited, and voiced by humans for quality assurance. Enjoy the show.
On the 23rd of February 2022, we were sitting in the president's office. It was another invasion day. There were several times it could have started. We sat there until about 1 a.m., waiting and waiting, and nothing happened. I was the first to give up and say that I would go home to sleep.
David Arakamiya, head of the Servant of the People parliamentary faction, recounts the night before the full-scale invasion. He lives with his wife and six children outside Kyiv. Arriving at home around 2 in the morning, he put his phone in sleep mode and immediately fell asleep.
To be honest, I slept through everything then. I still sleep through air raid warnings. And I always have my phone on do not disturb mode. It's configured to decline all incoming calls the first time around. But if the caller tries again, it recognizes that the call is likely urgent and lets it go through. That's how Andriy Yermak, head of the office of the President of Ukraine, got through to me. It was about 4 in the morning, and he said, "It started. Come here." Whilst I was driving, I live near the Odessa highway, where the village of Vita Poshtova is. I noticed a deafening explosion to my right. There was some kind of base there. I didn't know that at the time, but I floored the pedal and jumped a red light. It usually takes me around 40 minutes to drive to work. That morning, I made it to the office of the president on Bankova Street in only 15. When I reached the office, the president was already there, as well as Yermak and Oleksiy Demilov, secretary of the National Security and Defense Council of Ukraine. I think. Andriy Sibiha, deputy head of the office of the president of Ukraine, was there, and as far as I recall, Mykhailo Podolak, an advisor to the head of the office of the president of Ukraine, had also already arrived.
Around the same time, the chairman of the Verkhovna Rada, Ruslan Stefanchuk, rushed to Bankova Street from the left bank of Kyiv.
The president came out in a white shirt and said, "Well, it's begun." And then he said the following phrase, "Fate has chosen us."
Obviously, none of those present in Zelensky's office at that moment had chosen this fate. The next few hours and the following days would prove to be decisive in Ukraine's modern history, the country being forced to prove that it was capable of defending its independence. The situation was no less challenging for Ukraine's leaders. Some of them would leave Kyiv within the first few hours, possessions in tow, and make a run for the country's western regions. Others would rise to the challenge and move from the highest government offices to the so-called Facility Number 1, the deepest, most cramped bomb shelter, which would practically house the country's entire government for the first few days. The image of the sheltered presidential post where the top officials of the Cabinet of Ministers, the President's Office, and the Verkhovna Rada gathered on the 24th of February 2022 was a snapshot of the resistance movement as a whole, sometimes poorly organized, but always steadfast in its determination. You're listening to 2402, The Invasion Reconstructed, a podcast by Ukrainska Pravda. Episode 3, Facility Number 1, or All Power in Zelensky's Bunker. Ukrainska Pravda continues its podcast series 2402, The Invasion Reconstructed, and brings its readers the third fascinating episode about life in the presidential bunker in the early days of the full-scale invasion. 24th of February 2022, 10 a.m. In a room on the third floor of the president's office, David Arakamiya is reading messages sent by the military to the heads of parliamentary factions about new missile strikes and the current situation on the front lines. Arakamiya spices up the messages with foul words and occasional attempts at jokes as he reads them out loud. All of those present are tense, but quite composed given the extraordinariness of the situation. At one point, the president enters the room, along with Prime Minister Denis Shmigal and the head of the office of the president, Andriy Yermak.
Розповів про те, що він знає, що...
The president said he knew where the strikes had been carried out and that we were now mobilizing all military and paramilitary forces, the entire defense sector, in fact, so as to build some front lines.
Аракамія recalls.
І попросив прем'єра, щоб він займався цією...
Zelensky asked the prime minister to handle all the operational stuff while he would focus on international issues. It was very important to call everyone, tell everyone, ask for help, and so on. I remember that at first it was hard to see the president in a calm state because he was always calling someone or someone was calling him. It was like a call center, you know.
At one point, as Ukrainska Pravda has described in a previous episode, a meeting between Zelensky and the MPs was interrupted by the president's bodyguards. Ruslan Stefanchuk recalls,
Some guys from the president's security service came in and said that there was enemy movement towards Bankova Street, so the president had to leave.
To give you some idea of the atmosphere of that moment, which could only be called commotion, the chairman of the parliament ended up locked out of the protected shelter in which the president took refuge, despite having a designated space there. Yet people who shouldn't officially have access were able to enter.
When the guards came in, they took me and the president. Well, actually, I just followed them.
Аракамія admits. He also described his first impressions of the presidential bunker upon descending.
It looked like the film Stalker, to be honest. If you've ever visited Первомайск and seen the Museum of Rocket Forces, where strategic nuclear weapons such as the Satan, a Soviet-made missile, known to the West as the SS-18, were stored, you'll know what I mean. The trip to the bunker was very reminiscent of the descent to the missile silo.
Alexander Kubrakov, who also spent a few days in Facility Number 1 as a minister, having since been promoted to deputy prime minister after the situation became more normalized, recalls his own first impression.
Everything was like this, a long lift, then some stairs, then heavy doors, long corridors. In general, everything was as Soviet as possible. It's somewhere deep underground. You go down and down. It looks like a subway. It felt like it was built around the same time as the Kiev Metro. Everything is the same. That's about it.
Viktor Yanukovych used to be president, and he definitely toured this facility. When you become president, you're shown around it. I was wondering why he didn't redecorate anything for himself.
Аракамія says sardonically, referencing the renovations at the presidential office building, where even a bathhouse and gym were built during Yanukovych's tenure. The depressing Sovietness of everyday life turned out to be something that one could get used to quite quickly. But there were also some psychological realities that loomed larger with each passing hour. Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov recalls,
It's psychologically taxing. The air is different. It's a closed-loop system. You breathe the air, it seems to be purified, but you're aware that there are a lot of people sharing that same air.
Kubrakov recalls the two other things about underground life that depressed him the most.
For me it was, of course, the lack of light. You don't know whether it's day or night outside. Underground, it's about the same state. For me, the lack of awareness of the current time, well, it's hard. It's not normal for a person to be in this state all the time. That's the first thing. And the second was when the internet went down a couple of times. The connection dropped suddenly and it was like, whoops, that's it. You don't know what's going on in the world. As for the air, we eventually resorted to venturing outside to get some fresh air, staying near the office.
Those who have read up on the life of Vladimir Putin may have heard tales of entire cities hidden underground, and maybe there's some truth to that in Russia. But Ukraine's facility number one, once built to protect Communist Party leadership in the event of a nuclear strike, turned out to have very modest living facilities.
The rooms, bedrooms and workrooms are small. They're all very small. Everything is minimalist. They're nothing special,
says Deputy Prime Minister Kubrakov.
There are offices for two, three, or four people to work in at the same time. The bedrooms also vary, holding either one, two, or three people.
Zelensky's office was no different from the others, David Arakamia recalls.
Zelensky lived in very poor conditions, especially for a president. There was a five-person office with a rectangular table, almost always full, and the president slept in a corner cramped enough that I felt bad for him. I said, let's change this. Our accommodations in the bunker were surprisingly more spacious than the president's. Conditions were Spartan, to say the least.
The presidential suite's only perk was the private shower, but it wasn't private for long.
The president had a small shower reserved for his use, but the taboo was soon broken and others began using the presidential shower because the shared shower in the corridor was considered unsatisfactory. When I arrived, we no longer had any rooms to ourselves because Podolyak had occupied Stefanchuk's room, intended for the parliamentary leadership. And I remember living with Vice Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk. We had two bunk beds in a small barracks. I don't know how big it was, maybe 11 or 12 square meters. Podolyak's assumed room had its own toilet. Ours was in the corridor next to all of the offices. This led to a lot of class hatred, if you will, because he took Stefanchuk's office, he laughs. We couldn't exactly evict him, given the circumstances. I tried to tactfully say that this was parliamentary property and that he should leave, but nevertheless.
Meanwhile, Stefanchuk, the speaker of the Verkhovna Rada, whose room Podolyak occupied, had to seek shelter in various locations around the capital. By agreement with Zelensky, the Speaker of the Parliament and the President were never in the same place at the same time, so that if one of them was killed, the other could take control of the nation. So while Zelensky and his team were protected by concrete and soil, Stefanchuk had to be creative when it came to finding protection.
We did the Kyiv shuffle for a month. Those guys will know what I mean.
He nods to the guards.
Every day we changed locations, spending nights with random people in different places, but always remaining close enough to reach Kyiv.
Whilst the speaker was learning to work from various random offices, including a goat farm, a routine would gradually develop in the bunker. The early days were an adrenaline rush for everyone. Unending negotiations, work meetings, calls and staff meetings, punctuated here and there by a few hours of sleep at a time, blurred together. As one bunker resident said, the first 3 days are all one memory. It is simply impossible to tease out what individual events happened and when. For example, nobody could agree on when an improvised gym was set up in the corridor of the government bunker. Oleksiy Reznikov recalls,
we met with the president on the 24th of February in his quarters, obviously, and then I would visit him in the bunker every day. What I liked about his bunker was that the guys already had all of this sports equipment set up. Maybe it was there before, I don't know. There were pull-up bars, a small barbell, and kettlebells so the men from the State Guard could train. I was thinking, cool, everything's all right, life goes on.
Those dry rations were bad food. We've all gained 10 to 12 kilograms. I've put on 15 or 16 kilograms eating them.
David Arakamia recalls.
And then Podolyak and I remembered that Kirillo Tymoshenko, then deputy head of the president's office, had a fridge full of good wine in his office, and we went to loot it. It was nighttime. I noticed how the presidential office building looked at night, lit by floodlights. It looked like something out of a horror movie, you know? Everything was covered with sandbags. We were making our way through when we stepped on a State Guard member. We apologized. Because all of the corridors were cut off from the grid, we relied on the flashlights of our phones. The wine was absolutely delicious. You know the feeling, to be nervous and bored for ages, and then finally find some wine. It was like our little celebration.
Such brief tastes of freedom became possible a few days after the invasion. On the very first day, Zelensky's small office in the bunker was constantly crowded with people. It has to be said that there are a lot of people for such a top-secret facility. Immediately after meeting the heads of the factions, Arakamiya, Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal, and head of the president's office Andriy Yermak went down to the shelter with Zelensky. The Prime Minister's right-hand man Oleg Nemchinov, Deputy Prime Minister Irina Verishchuk, and Yermak's deputies Andriy Sibiha and Roman Mashovets were there too. As time passed, more and more visitors would come down to see Zelensky. Some of them stayed with the president for a long time, which was incredibly annoying for his bodyguards.
We lived in relative isolation. I remember that when someone came, it was a big event, although the security would interfere all the time. I didn't want too many people to even be aware of this facility's existence,
Arakamiya recalls. However, despite the security guard's wishes, the president's bunker gradually began to look more like a location from The Mitten, a Ukrainian fairy tale in which a lot of animals wanted to live in a little mitten, than a top-secret facility. Oleksandr Kubrakov recalls,
We came to Zelensky's bunker. Well, it was already quite late. It was me, MP Mustafa Nayem, Deputy Minister Yuri Vaskov, and Oleksandr Kamishin, then head of National Railway Operator Ukrzaliznitsa. The guards told the guys to wait. I said, I'll be back in half an hour. But I went in there and stayed for about 2 to 2.5 hours because the president had one negotiation after another. Macron called him, then Duda, and then someone else on WhatsApp. And I saw how intense it was, and I said, listen, my guys are waiting for me there. He said, so tell them to come over here. So he asked them to come, then we talked, and then the Prime Minister returned from some negotiations, and Andriy Yermak arrived. Zelensky said, so, let's all stay here. And this was some kind of meeting room. Stay, you'll work from here.
While the armed forces of Ukraine were coordinating defensive operations and fighting their first battles against the Russian army, the president and his team had many urgent issues to resolve. They had to ensure that the state would continue to function in the face of the invasion, provide everything the armed forces needed, obtain international support, and convince the leaders of other countries that Ukraine was resilient enough to not fall in 2 or 3 days. David Arakamiya recalls,
In the first few days, there was a lot of fussing about. There were no properly organized, structured processes at all. The bunker is a classified facility, so we can't disclose any major details right now. But there are sectors there, in theory. In practice, nobody paid any heed to the sector system because everyone was running to see each other, reporting to each other, and so on. There are special communications, video communications, mobile communications, and so on. At first, information went through all possible channels. Later, the normal security protocols were once again obeyed. I remember that there were a lot of international calls, and I was always itching to jump in, to say something, to participate somehow, because some world leaders disappointed us. Almost all of them did. We were in a very weak position. Everyone was afraid of Putin. Everyone who called. But the more often they called, the more we realized that they were just afraid to supply powerful weapons right away, fearing uncontrolled escalation by Russia. It seems to me that one of the main things the war achieved is making the leaders themselves no longer afraid of Putin going scorched earth over proportionate responses. This is very important if the current world order is to continue to exist.
Zelensky was in constant communication with another bunker, where Commander-in-Chief Valery Zaluzhny and his generals were commanding the country's defense. Several of Ukrainska Pravda's sources were also in Zaluzhny's military bunker too. According to David Arakamiya, the armed forces chief's safe house is much smaller than the presidential one and isn't a place anyone would want to shelter for an extended period.
I visited Valery Zaluzhny, but I didn't have much time to feel the special atmosphere. You need to live there for a day or two to understand what it's like.
The presidential bunker, also known as Facility Number 1, is a permanent facility. It's a capital asset, you know. Whereas over there, at the Commander-in-Chief's, it's more of a temporary facility.
Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov, who was staying in Zaluzhny's bunker, said that there are many protected command posts like his and Zaluzhny's across the country.
Valery Zaluzhny and I officially have a network of offices across the country. There are different military command posts which we can work from if necessary. We had a discussion with him to ensure that in an emergency, we would know where we were moving and be on the same page regarding the point or points we would meet at. At every command post, there is always an office shared by the minister and commander-in-chief, a space that can serve as a reception area, a workroom, a small recreation room, and a bathroom.
Even though the network of protected bunkers, which do not only serve the armed forces, is quite extensive, it will have to be completely rebuilt and maybe even relocated after the victory over Russia. Oleksiy Reznikov explains,
"We had instructions on what to do if a full-scale war started. The instructions specified that all of the ministries had to have their own command posts. All of them, even the Ministry of Sport and the Ministry of Culture. And where do you think the majority of our ministry's backup command posts were located? In Kharkiv, Chernihiv, and Sumy oblasts. This is because in Soviet times, the threat was expected to arise from the West. The brotherly Russian nation was no threat. So all the command posts were right in the path of the invading forces. This is why we need to make new decisions nowadays and build new command posts for each ministry in other cities."
On the 24th of February, Reznikov was supposed to go down to Zaluzhny's command post and manage things from there, but didn't in the end.
"I'd seen my place in the bunker before that. They showed it to me when I came to office. But I only went down there after 3 days, as far as I remember. During the first 3 days, I was migrating all over Kyiv,"
the defense minister recalls. Reznikov, like Speaker Stefanchuk, had to move to a different location in or near the city of Kyiv every night. He mostly paid surprise visits to the homes of his friends who had left the country on the day of the invasion.
"I didn't spend 2 nights in a row in the same place. I had the opportunity to go home once every 3 or 4 days, get some clean clothes, feed the cat, give it some cat food and water. I spent each night in a new location, at my friends' places, without warning. I'd analyze where I was and when I would be free, and I'd tell my friend, 'I'm coming to your place.' And everyone welcomed me, even friends who had gone and who had large families. I knew where the key was hidden. I'd go to their place, open their door, and spend the night there. It was apartments, dachas, whatever, even garages. I spent a few days in the bunker as well. But I hated it there, so I got out quickly. I probably only spent 2 nights there."
The accommodations at his friends' places sometimes surprised the Ukrainian defense minister with luxuries that the Soviet command posts definitely lacked, such as a spa room in the sauna.
"My friend gave me instructions on how I could warm it up. I went to the sauna to get warm, to at least detox a bit and then have some rest. So I was in the sauna when suddenly I got a text from my virtual waiting room saying that the Australian defense minister had agreed to talk to me in 15 minutes. He was flying on his way somewhere and was ready to talk. I said, 'Okay.' I took off my sauna hat, still wearing felt boots and a dressing gown, and put my fleece jacket on over it. The jacket has my last name and position on a Velcro label, and that's how I looked as I Skyped the minister."
When Reznikov needed to visit his office down in the bunker, he made an effort to not greet Commander Zaluzhny and his team empty-handed.
"I started taking some fresh peppers and tomatoes with me, and I'd call Zaluzhny to let him know, 'Mr. Zaluzhny, I've brought some fresh food,' and I'd bring it to the bunker. Or I'd say, 'Come to my office.' He'd say, 'Wow, fresh air.' I'd invite him to have some coffee. I was in my office above them, and they were down in the bunker. I know for sure that Zaluzhny Moisyuk, who is deputy commander-in-chief of Ukraine's armed forces, and Shaptala, chief of the general staff, visited me during this time."
If Zaluzhny needed anything, the president could connect him with someone from his team. On the evening of the 24th of February, Zelensky called Kubrakov and asked if he had Zaluzhny's phone number.
No, I don't, I replied. I only worked with Shaptalov before the war. He then said, you're going to get a text with a number. They need to send a brigade from Lviv Oblast to Kyiv Oblast urgently. Talk to Zaluzhny and explain the time frame to him and me. I called Zaluzhny and explained the situation. Then I called the president and told him what Zaluzhny had said, to which he replied, no, that's too late. We need it 4 to 5 hours sooner. So I called Zaluzhny again. But we managed to sort everything out eventually.
Kubrakov is now convinced that isolating the top leadership of Ukraine and concentrating it in one place might have been decisive for the success of the resistance.
This is because a lot of decisions about providing troops with this or that, about the subordination of some bodies or some military tasks, all of this could happen very quickly in one office. A government meeting was held twice a day, morning and evening, and all the agreements and decisions were being handled very quickly. I think we've even gone backwards since then. The level of bureaucracy regarding many issues is even higher than before the war. In the first few days of the war, decisions were made right away. No one gave them a second thought. We just rushed forward. The military was provided with everything they needed. Everyone understood the risks, especially near Kyiv. I've seen the statistics. The Russians were already on the west bank of the Dnipro River near Fastiv and on the east bank near Brovary. And it occurred to me that all they had left to seize was the Kyiv-Odessa highway. And this made you want to help the military even more. Guys, what else do you need? Is there anything or anyone we can send over to you? Because I felt so bad about it.
International cooperation was faster as well, Kubrakov recalls.
You text a minister in the UK and he'd send you the number of the CEO of BP, the CEO of Shell. The American embassy would send you the number of the CEO of Exxon, and you'd call them right from the bunker. We need fuel. Yeah, wait a sec, we're on it, and so on. That's how easy it was.
One of the key issues left unresolved was how to contact Russia and understand what it actually wanted.
We didn't understand the whole denazification thing, or any of the other incomprehensible terms Putin used in his video address. Nobody really understood what he actually meant by that,
recalls Arakamiya, who later became the main negotiator with Russia for the next few months. Arakamiya recalled that the first opportunity to find out what the Russians wanted appeared when Alexander Lukashenko, self-proclaimed president of Belarus, put himself forward as a negotiator with Kyiv. Even though convoys of military equipment were moving towards Kyiv from Belarusian territory, his offer was accepted.
It was the 24th or 25th of February, I think. Yevhen Shevchenko, a notorious member of the Ukrainian parliament with ties to Lukashenko, somehow got in touch with him and forwarded the call to my phone through Ukraine's defense intelligence chief Budarnov. Lukashenko called me via WhatsApp. The president refused to talk to him, but I convinced him otherwise. I'll put him on speakerphone so we can at least hear what he wanted to say, because they're conducting the offensive from that direction. We just wanted answers, and thought that he might have been intending to disclose valuable information.
It was during that conversation that Ukraine's leadership first made an agreement to meet with the Russians. The delegation was put together relatively quickly, its members selected from those in the bunker who were available and had preferably had some contact with Belarusians or Russians before the invasion. David Arakamiya explains,
Podolyak knew the late Belarusian foreign minister Vladimir Makey from their Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He somehow made connections in Belarus a long time ago. He'd been deported back then, I think. And he says, I know this Makey guy. I say, come with us then, because you have at least one personal contact. Reznikov knew Russian ambassador to Belarus Grizlov from the Minsk process. As to why I was chosen, it wasn't really discussed. Well, they called me on my phone informing me I was going, So we just went, and that was that. There were no coordinated plans to form a delegation. We just didn't have the time. How could we call the person at the foreign ministry we were ordinarily supposed to call to handle the formation process if we didn't even know where the ministry's members were at the time? We gathered those around us and just went.
Those who happened to be nearby at the time did as much work as they could. No matter what kind of personal relationships these people had had before, the first few days of the Russian invasion separated true friends from foes. It was then that something you might call bunker brotherhood was born in the cramped, fortified command posts of Kyiv.
Я тоді не відчував, але потім це нормальний.
I didn't feel it back then. I only realized it later. It's a normal quirk of human nature. When someone is prepared to die with you, and isn't just saying that, but really means it, that resonates with you. That's what Denis Monastirsky, the former Minister of Internal Affairs, always told me. Two top officials stayed with him. He said, "They will always be with me, because they were willing to die with me. I have a moral obligation to them."
David Arakamia recalls. Alexander Kubrakov shares similar feelings.
I understand, or at least try to tell myself, that the only people who were there with me were Mustafa Nayem, head of the State Agency for Reconstruction and Infrastructure Development, and Yuri Vaskov, Deputy Minister of Infrastructure. They walked this path with me. I got to know them much better, and they showed their best side. This was great. As far as relationships in the bunker in general are concerned, they were taken to the next level in every sense, because it was like being in a submarine. Concepts like rank and hierarchy don't always matter as much. It's a little different. And some interactions were a lot more sincere, for sure. Even after the stay in the bunker, there was a period where we could discuss unpleasant matters relatively calmly and openly, but in a sincere manner, in a team and with the president.
On the evening of the 24th of February, Verkhovna Rada Speaker Ruslan Stefanchuk, who had to keep his distance from the president, returned to parliament. He was harrowed imagining how many historical sites might have been captured by the Russian occupiers.
We left the Verkhovna Rada that evening. The only thing we took with us was the flag of independence. We believe those bastards didn't have the right to take that. That flag traveled with me around the outskirts of Kyiv in a backpack carried by one of us. Now it's back in its rightful place, because we knew for sure that neither the flag nor the constitution of Ukraine and the act on state sovereignty could be captured by the orcs. These were the things we took with us.
As Stefanchuk was leaving the Verkhovna Rada, followed by the sounds of explosions, his American counterpart Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, contacted him.
It was late in the evening. We took the flag and so on and went into the garage of the Verkhovna Rada. I had asked my team to contact Pelosi in the morning, but she only got in touch with me late in the evening, and it seems surreal. She called me on my phone, the first time we talked without interpreters or any other assistance. And I said, "You know, this is a scary situation. I beg you, kick Congress into high gear. The U.S. Congress and the country as a whole must support Ukraine." She replied very calmly, "Don't worry, Mr. Speaker, I will do everything in my power. I guarantee the support of the U.S. And right at that moment, there were more explosions. I said, "Excuse me, I have to keep moving, so just do your thing. We'll definitely meet later. Or maybe not."
You've been listening to the third episode of 2402, The Invasion Reconstructed, a podcast by Ukrainska Pravda. Please rate and leave comments under this podcast. It will help it to break through the filters to the widest audience possible. Consider subscribing to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, or via RSS on Captivate.fm.
To be continued.